PPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA with attendance only twice per term. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Hope you're having a good morning so far. All right, coming up later in the show, we'll speak with an LA Unified School District board member about a plan to house homeless students on LAUSD property. We'll have more on that in about 15 minutes. First, though, fires. The Camp and Woolsey fires have dominated our news coverage for the past week. So a quick update on the blaze that's affecting us locally. The Woolsey fire is now 57% contained. 98,000 acres have burned so far, and more than 500 structures have been destroyed, a number that is expected to grow. One of the hardest hit areas was the city of Malibu, but some people never left despite mandatory evacuation orders. LA County Fire Chief Daryl Osby has expressed frustration with people in the path of the Woolsey fire who ignored officials' orders to get out. He said they were making firefighters' jobs more difficult, and of course, those who refuse to leave are putting themselves at risk. Malibu City Councilman Jefferson Wagner did not evacuate. He ended up getting hospitalized with injuries he sustained unsuccessfully trying to save his home. Every time there's a big fire, there are people who don't evacuate. In some cases, people who do stay behind save their homes and sometimes their neighbors' homes. KPCC's Sharon McNary says that raises a policy question that firefighters would rather not confront.
From Wheeler to Clearpoint.
On the night the Thomas Fire broke out, it raced toward Clearpoint, a hilly neighborhood of hundreds of homes in Ventura.
Put mandatory into Clearpoint, please, and on to Londo.
Ventura city officials ordered a mandatory evacuation, but Adam Mango stayed to protect his mother's house. The wind-driven fire pelted the house with embers, starting spot fires he put out with water from the backyard hot tub.
The flames did come in. It was touching the house, and I was using buckets after buckets and crawling on my hands and knees. I mean, it was a spiritual moment.
The Thomas Fire burned most of his neighbors' homes, but he saved his mom's house. Mango was better prepared than most. He'd worked briefly as a firefighter and had some protective gear. He shared his experience with a group of fire experts touring the area this summer. They gathered on a bare lot where Mango's neighbor's house burned. He told them their evacuation orders fall short.
The plans just don't include residents who are prepared, able-bodied, and want to stay and actually help the firefighting efforts.
He got immediate pushback from Ventura City Fire Department Assistant Chief Matt Brock.
You had a plan. It's that simple. Yeah. The general public doesn't, and that's just the difference.
This is the dilemma fire officials face in every big fire. They know people stay behind, about 10% according to fire science studies. Ventura City Fire Marshal Joe Morelli said during the Thomas Fire, his own neighbor stayed behind at great risk to himself and helped put out spot fires.
I told him, look, I can't tell you weren't supposed to evacuate. I work for the fire department, but thank you for what you did in the community because I know that he saved some homes.
But officially, the state doesn't want to do anything that could be interpreted as encouraging people to stay. That's why firefighters' official slogan is Ready, Set, Go. It stresses preparing your home to withstand fire and then getting out when authorities tell you to. CAL FIRE Deputy Director Mike Moeller says California has no policy to train people how to save their homes if they disregard an evacuation order.
We do not support that at all, and I think it could give the false sense of security to the public.
He says the state would not want to assume the liability of training people to stay behind.
The risk versus gain is not something that we would be willing to compromise. Our job is to get the public out of harm's way.
Not that long ago, the state's fire officials were thinking very differently about this. In 2009, as fire officials saw more people refusing to evacuate, they considered adopting a new policy. It would call for training people to leave early or stay and defend their homes. It was modeled on a similar policy that's been used for decades in Australia. But that year came Black Saturday, a disastrous series of fires in Australia that killed 173 people. Bob Roper was Ventura County Fire Chief at the time and a key advocate of adopting the new policy.
We had an aha moment to put the brakes on the Leave Early or Stay and Defend program and modify it over to Ready, Set, Go.
Again, here's Ventura City Fire Marshal Joe Morelli.
And we're not going to tell them don't prepare, don't have their plan. But as far as us endorsing or putting a message out there, hey, you should stay and, you know, protect, we don't want anyone to be in harm's way.
CAL FIRE Administrative Chief Dennis Burns says on top of the physical danger, most people don't understand what it's like to come face to face with a raging wildfire. He tells the story of a Northern California man who stayed behind during a fire and saved his home.
This is like a man's man, you know, he's done all this stuff, but he was just bawling, just, you know, just breaking down because he's like, you, no way he could have prepared for the actual mental, emotional side that was out there.
But people like Adam Mango, who saved his mom's house in Ventura during the Thomas Fire, think it would make sense to train volunteers to stay and defend their homes. Fire Marshal Morelli shuts this line of thinking right down.
We had a firefighter die on this fire who was from CAL FIRE and very, very experienced, and he died.
So while there are brave and well-prepared residents who save their homes from fire, the inherent risk means firefighters will continue to insist people leave when fire threatens. I'm Sharon McNary.
Okay, moving on now to the border. We're going to check back in on a story that dominated headlines in the weeks leading up to the election, that caravan of migrants heading north through Mexico. Hundreds of people from that group have made it to Tijuana, and more are expected to arrive in the next few days. Reporter Rebecca Plevin is with the Desert Sun. She's been on the border in recent days. Rebecca, nice to talk to you again.
Hey, good to talk to you.
All right, Rebecca, I was looking at your Twitter account, and you were out on the beach last night in Tijuana, where a lot of these migrants have camped out. Describe that scene for us. How about how many people are there?
Sure. So, you know, during the day yesterday, hundreds of migrants set up camp down by the beach, you know, near the Pacific Ocean, steps from the border fence that, you know, separates Mexico and the United States, and they were camping out there. You know, the city of Tijuana has limited shelter space right now, and you know, I think the migrants said that they all wanted to sleep together, and so they decided to camp out by the beach. And by the evening, things had gotten really tense because, you know, the migrants were wanted to sleep there, and local residents of the Playa de Tijuana neighborhood, where that, you know, space is, local residents really were worried about their security, and so they wanted all the migrants to leave the beach and go to shelters.
Yeah.
And so there was this confrontation down at the beach that became very tense.
Didn't become violent, did it? Or just did it just stay tense?
You know, so I was down there probably for about 3 hours until about midnight, and I would say there were about like 300 residents and then hundreds of migrants and at least 36 municipal and federal police officers. There were times where people were definitely pushing and shoving. And I think a couple, you know, punches were thrown. It really got intense.
Now, these migrants are mostly from Honduras. How many more are expected to arrive in the coming days?
That's a great question. We had heard as of last night, local officials were expecting about 2,000 more migrants. They might have even already have arrived today. And those are still members of a first caravan. And keep in mind that there are at least two other caravans that are making their way through Mexico right now. Last I had heard, the second caravan had definitely reached Mexico City. The third caravan is probably near Mexico City or there by now. So this is still the first wave of migrants. We don't know if the second and third caravans, we don't know if they will come to Tijuana, which is a pretty far journey, they will go to a different part of the border.
And some are arriving by bus. Who's arranging for the buses?
That's a great question. It's one that I've been getting a lot. I think typically the idea is that the local, the state governments in Mexico will provide buses for people just to keep them, you know, moving through Mexico. I know at least the first bus, the first wave of migrants that got here this week, there was questions about whether it was a state government or someone else. But generally I hear that it's Mexican state governments that are just helping people move through their state.
We're talking to reporter Rebecca Plevin. She's with the Desert Sun. She's been on the border in recent days as certain migrants have arrived in Tijuana. What are Mexican officials saying about this? And actually, can they handle an influx of people like this?
Yeah. So I was at a press conference last night, and there were, you know, Tijuana officials and Baja California state officials. You know, they're saying at this point that this is not a humanitarian crisis. You know, that was a question they got, is this a humanitarian crisis? And they're saying, you know, this is a lot of migrants, but it's not the most that we've received. You know, they talked about receiving a couple of years ago, there was a huge wave of migrants from Haiti that arrived in Baja California. Yeah. So they're saying this isn't the biggest wave they've seen, but I think what is different about this one is that there's so many people arriving in such a short period of time. Last night, the local and state officials announced they were opening up a sports complex where about 360 migrants will be able to sleep temporarily. We were there last night. You know, there's lots of thin mattresses just laid side by side by side. But the idea is that, you know, at least it's not cold there and it's safe and they'll get food. And so I think they were especially hoping that women and children and older migrants would take up their offer and go sleep at that shelter.
Rebecca, you've been talking to members of this migrant group. What are their plans? Will they stay in Mexico? Will they try to go to the U.S. and apply for asylum? What have they told you?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point also. When I speak to migrants, I think the dominant thing that I hear over and over is that people left Honduras because there is just no work there. There's no work. There's no opportunities. They need to feed their families. And for that reason, they are, you know, traveling north to the U.S. in search of work. When I ask people specifically if they're trying to seek asylum, you know, from the people I've spoken with, I get the sense that they don't really understand U.S. immigration policy, and so maybe they don't understand asylum or don't know what it requires. But I think the dominant thing I'm hearing is this really strong desire to go work in the U.S.
All right, that's Rebecca Plevin of the Desert Sun reporting from the U.S.-Mexico border. Rebecca, thank you very much.
Thank you, A.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. Offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by December 1st to be considered for a $2,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The LA Unified School District voted Tuesday to study a proposal to use LAUSD property for housing homeless students. There are anywhere from 16,000 to 21,000 homeless students in the district, depending on how you count it. Now, the plan is still in early stages, but there are a lot of questions on how to pay for this project and how it would all work. So we reached out to LAUSD school board member Kelly Gonez for some answers. Gonez authored the resolution, and she's here to break it all down. Welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now, fill us in on all the details. If this were to go forward, how would it work?
So the resolution is aimed at deepening our support for the thousands of homeless students who are in LAUSD, and it calls on the superintendent to report back to the school board in 6 months on two things. First, we'll be looking at the feasibility of using district facilities that could be schools, parking lots, office buildings for temporary or permanent shelter for our homeless families. So that could include opening up our parking lots for overnight parking, using our gyms as shelter during winter and summer recess, or converting or building permanent supportive housing. Currently, we also have school sites that have closed, as well as office buildings, all kinds of properties.
Okay. Well, any infrastructure changes needed that you are aware of right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the report will really dig into the details of cost and what changes would be needed. But of course, the first requirement would be funding. For any of these, even the temporary ones, if we were to use district parking lots for overnight parking, for example, we would, of course, need outside funding for additional security, maintenance, and caseworkers. And then if we look at the larger options, such as converting or building new facilities for homeless families, we would, of course, need to make a number of changes to those facilities to ensure that they're safe and habitable.
Okay. Now, not everyone on the school board was in favor of this idea, but what did Superintendent Austin Buettner have to say about it?
So Austin spoke to the fact that our core mission as a school district is really educating our students, and that we know that homelessness is one key barrier that a number of our students are facing in terms of attending and succeeding in school. He also spoke to potentially doing a pilot program looking at one high-needs community that is facing a high rate of homelessness as a way to do a test case.
And that's in Pacoima, right?
Yeah, he mentioned Telfair Elementary School, which is one of the schools that I represent.
Why this school?
So Telfair Elementary for the last several years has had the highest rate of homelessness in all of LUSD. This year, they have about 20% of their students are homeless, which is tied with another elementary school in my district as the highest throughout LUSD.
Now, I think a big question, Kelly, is still hanging in the air about the funding about this project. I know it's the early stages. I realize that. But how will LAUSD pay for this type of housing? Will it have to tap into some of these measures that have been passed recently?
Yeah, so I think we absolutely will need to, as I said, be working in partnership with the county and the city. We know that thanks to the voters of Los Angeles, there is new funding for programs and for building housing through Measures H and HHH. So we would absolutely need to tap into those bond dollars in order to make changes. And I think the district could potentially look at tapping into other sources of funds that we might have when it comes to providing more personnel or wraparound support.
We're talking to LAUSD school board member Kelly Gonez. What gave you the idea to even start this?
So before I was a board member, I was actually a teacher in the San Fernando Valley, and I taught students who were experiencing homelessness. And I saw my students come to school tired and hungry because they didn't have a safe or stable place to sleep at night or meals when they weren't at school, let alone having a place to do their homework. And then last year, my first year in office as a board member, I visited all of the schools in my board district. And I saw and I heard from my principals and teachers about the impact of increasing homelessness on the education we provide in our schools and classrooms. You know, as an advocate for my community and for the entire district, I knew we needed to do more to meet the unique needs of our homeless students, and that it was urgent that we did something now.
There's a lot of effort in LA to figure out the best way to house the homeless. I'm sure you know that, Kelly. There's been a lot of pushback from residents anytime a solution is brought up. What have you heard from Angelenos about this idea? And are you worried about getting a lot of resident pushback?
I think of course that has to be a consideration. We want to make sure that not only is this something that serves the homeless students and families, but that residents also feel good about having this in their community. So it's certainly something we're looking at. What I would emphasize is that this is just a first step to consider our potential options, including the housing side as well as the supports we provide in school. And when it comes to choosing a site, we will of course have robust community engagement because we want to hear from the community and we want to make sure we're responsive to their concerns. And ultimately, the goal is any facilities that we decide to utilize need to be safe and secure for the school community, for the residents, as well as the homeless families themselves.
So if this thing goes forward, it would go forward in all kinds of neighborhoods in LA, regardless of the wealth of those neighborhoods?
I think it's a bit premature to say where exactly we would be looking at this point, but the direction to the superintendent is to look at all of our facilities. You know, my intention is that we're looking all over the community. I think we want to maybe prioritize the neighborhoods where we're seeing the highest rate of homelessness among those students and families. But I think at this point, we've got to look at the full spectrum.
All right. So what has to happen to make this resolution a reality?
The superintendent will be looking at what options are feasible given our existing facilities. And we'll be having many conversations with our potential partners at the city, at the county, as well as in our nonprofit organizations. The other part of the resolution is looking at the school supports that we already have for our homeless students, to see how we can improve the programs that already exist within LA Unified. As we do this, we'll be seeking input from our community partners and our constituents to get their feedback. And then in 6 months, the superintendent will see that report that the superintendent provides, and then we can then assess what actions we can take to help homeless students and families.
Kelly Gonez is an LAUSD school board member who authored the resolution to house homeless students on district property. Kelly, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Ian Martinez. If you've never heard of Ken Block, you probably don't spend a lot of time on YouTube. The Long Beach native and motorsports superstar has racked up more than half a billion views for his Gymkhana video series. Now, if you don't know Gymkhana, it involves a race car and lots of squealing tires, and it's the focus of a new Amazon original series debuting tomorrow. It's also the subject of The Ride, our weekly look at personal mobility. Motor critic Sue Carpenter interviewed Ken Block this week. She brings us a story.
A lot of people might wonder why a person would strap into a race car careening within inches of concrete pillars and other unmovable objects at speeds exceeding 100 miles an hour. But it's this sort of automotive derring do that has made Ken Block into an extreme sports darling, even if most people have never heard of him.
Who is Ken Block? Insane.
If you get maimed, that makes the story more interesting.
The real Ken Block or the Ken Block you know?
He's an artist.
Ken Block is gnarly.
Dangerous.
It depends on the day.
That's some of Ken Block's staff attempting to explain their boss in the new Amazon Prime original series, The Gymkhana Files, debuting Friday. Gymkhana, for the uninitiated, is an automotive sport where drivers skillfully maneuver their cars around obstacles using extreme acceleration, braking, and drifting. And Block is its unofficial master.
Well, I'm a race car driver that has a very creative side to him, I guess you could say.
All right, we're ready to go.
Back in 2008, when Block released his first video, Gymkhana 1, sliding along the asphalt of an abandoned tarmac, narrowly missing stacks of tires and K-rails, he racked up almost 30 million views in just a couple months. That led to a franchise that has since become a viral phenomenon, with more than 500 million views.
Before this, if you were a motorsport fan, all you could do is turn on the TV and watch race coverage. This content that we've been making is the content I've wanted to watch. And it's great that it's been so popular with everybody else.
That's what it's like from the viewer's perspective. For Block, who's inside the car?
It's a lot of fun. On top of that, there's, a general feeling of nervousness because I have to do things that are quite difficult and sort of push the limit of my abilities and the car's abilities. The saying goes, if you're not scared, you're not going fast enough. And that's something I genuinely feel sometimes.
Now 50, Block grew up in Long Beach and was an avid skateboarder until the age of 13. Then his family moved to San Diego, where he switched to dirt bikes and eventually got into rallycross racing. To say he's an adrenaline junkie, well, that's an understatement. That's the sound of Ken Block as he slaloms up a two-lane mountain road without guardrails, drifting between snowplows, their blades spinning in episode one of the Gymkhana Files, which marks the 10-year anniversary of Block's Gymkhana videos by peeling back the curtain and showing how it's done.
Most of the fans and kids that tune in and watch these videos, well, they just see this very nicely polished video that's 10 or 15 minutes long, but they have no idea what it took to get there.
Like catching it all on camera, when his tires are precariously over water's edge, threatening to send him plummeting, or drifting under a lowrider in the mere seconds its front end is lifted off the ground. How many cameras?
A lot.
Block says it takes four main cameras and about 50 GoPros, which are mounted from every conceivable angle outside and inside the car, including on Block himself. And then there are the tires.
I'm there to kind of destroy them for fun and for making great entertainment.
For a sport that involves drifting across the pavement instead of gripping it, Block says it takes about 40 tires to shoot each Gymkhana video, which he pushes out on YouTube at the rate of about one each year. Block has raced about 20 cars over the years, but the one he used to speed up Colorado's Pikes Peak in the kickoff to his new Amazon Prime original series is a modified Ford Mustang.
You know, 60s muscle car with modern-day all-wheel drive technology and a very modern engine in it. It's genuinely the funnest thing I've ever driven. It just drives like I'm fighting its effort to kill me.
Surprisingly, Block has never broken a bone racing, only from snowboarding and dirt biking. testimony to Block's amazing driving skills and precision, now on display not only in his own Gymkhana videos, but Amazon's new documentary series about them. For Take Two, I'm Sue Carpenter.
All right, to football now. You know the old saying, a blessing in disguise? Well, that's exactly what happened earlier this week when the NFL decided to move the Rams' Monday night game out of Mexico City and to the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. Now, having the game in L.A. means the Rams can invite some of their neighbors, folks who could really use something fun in their lives. You see, the Rams' offices are in Agoura Hills, right in the middle of all the fires in the area, and they're only 7 miles away from the Borderline Bar and Grill. So the team is giving away thousands of tickets to first responders and people impacted by the fires and the shooting. Rams Chief Operating Officer Kevin Demoff is here to tell us all about it. Kevin, welcome.
Morning.
Now, the shooting happened very late on the night of Wednesday, November 7th. Kevin, what was the feeling in the team's offices the next morning, considering how close you guys are?
I think the first feeling was shock, anger, sadness, the normal feelings we all feel when we see these shootings on the news just hit much closer to home. And so the first thing was to make sure everybody in the organization was safe and accounted for. And then you're really trying to process those feelings and how you go about helping to respond. And the Conejo Valley, since we relocated back 3 years ago, we've really become one of the leading organizations, you know, publicly and privately, and we knew that people would turn to us to follow our response and that we could play a leadership role in how the community, you know, healed from that incident.
And then a few hours later, the Woolsey fire starts. The team was practicing at their facility at Cal Lutheran, but you have players and staff who live in the area. Kevin, how much were your heads and hearts spinning that day as an organization?
I would say it was surreal. I mean, when you think about we're practicing on a campus that's closed because they had lost students in the shooting just hours before. And during practice, you could see first it started with the Hill Fire and plumes of smoke to the east, and players started to get concerned, but we were able to finish practice. And then everybody was starting to evacuate from there. And then hours later, the Woolsey Fire breaks out, and we have roughly 100 staff evacuated in the middle of the night. Just trying to find accommodations, let alone football or anything else. They were just trying to keep their families safe.
Now, I've worked in sports a long time, Kevin. I know how focused sports organizations are on winning games. How did you guys manage when life and death is all around you for those few days?
I think you just postpone thinking about the games, to be honest. When you know, for the shooting, you think about, you know, unfortunately, it is an over and done with scenario. So you're thinking about how you can help heal. And sports have such a power to bring people together, and you started to think about what we could do for the families. And Andrew Whitworth, our Pro Bowl left tackle, donated his game check to the victims' families, and our players coming together. You know, but then the fire is very different. Half your organization is without a home. Your offices are completely closed. Our office in Agoura Hills, our practice facility at Cal Lutheran, both inaccessible in the fire zone. So you're just trying to figure out, okay, we have a game on Sunday, which is 72 hours away. How do we make sure everybody's safe and accounted for? And then how do we actually go from there? So we set up a command center for our group. We got everybody in a hotel. Stan Kroenke, our owner, graciously stepped up to pay for everybody's expenses while they were evacuated. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't have to worry about finances. And then we set about trying to figure out where we could practice on Saturday. Coach McVay canceled practice on Friday so everybody could be with their families. And we tried to figure out where we could just do a quick practice on Saturday ahead of our game against Seattle on Sunday.
Now to the Monday night game versus the Kansas City Chiefs, which, by the way, is one of the most anticipated, biggest games of the year. When it was moved to Los Angeles, what went into the decision to make free tickets available to your neighbors?
Well, I think the first thing, when we became aware of the possibility of the game moving Monday afternoon, we started internally brainstorming on how we can make this game a celebration. I think, as you said, we were fortunate enough that the game was going to be one of the games of the year in the NFL, two great teams playing. You know, the first Monday night game in Los Angeles in 33 years. But then it became obvious to us we had such an unbelievable opportunity to bring the community together to help the healing process and start to celebrate the people who kept our community safe. And we talked internally about how do we honor first responders and make this game a tribute to everybody who has stepped up in the past 10 days, both in the Conejo Valley, throughout the fire-affected areas, throughout the shootings. you know, to really honor them and to bring our community together. And that's where, you know, the thought process of giving away thousands of tickets to first responders and to victims, you know, making sure they get on it throughout the game, really, that's where it stemmed from, and we continue to work on it as we talk.
Now, are you planning anything special for Monday night's game other than giving away the tickets?
Well, we are planning a number of things. I think they're all in flux right now. It depends on the time and the hour. You get 5 days to plan for the biggest game of the year and 75,000 people at the Coliseum. You know, nothing gets set in stone quickly, but I think it'll be a tremendous celebration. Ticket sales have gone unbelievably well, and we hope to have a full and loud building and really do everything we can to make sure that when people are there, they get the chance to thank those who have done such an unbelievable job for the past week.
All right, that's Rams COO Kevin Demoff. Kevin, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And just a quick correction. Kevin mentioned that a Cal State Lutheran student died in the shooting. It was a former student, an alumnus of Cal Lutheran. All right, be sure to follow us on Twitter, at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can also follow me, Twitter, and Instagram, same address, at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA.